David Ware, Real 3. Now, we're talking about your first flight. You went to a satellite airfield of Luton, which we're not quite certain what it is at the moment, but we'll probably find out later. Now, what happened when you got to the airfield?
We worked in shifts, 12 in each shift, 24 students, 12 each, either you were A and B, either, and you went in the morning shift or the afternoon shift. And I was in A, and we arrived there. There were 12 students and 12 instructors who looked us up and down, and we had all our equipment with us. And they showed us how to put it on, took us to an aircraft each, and took us around the airplane, showed us the airplane, showed us the prop, showed us the engine, showed us how it worked. And then it said, right, boy, go and put your uniform on and put your flying kit on. We're going to have a flight. And we took off. Even on the first flight, they made you do some basic handling of straight and level flying and getting used to it.
Now, what was it? This is the first dual flight in a Tiger.
Yeah, in a Tiger Moth. Right from the word go, he had you doing something.
Now, what was the setup for instruction in the dual control Tiger Moth?
Well, the instructor sat in front and you sat behind. And there was a mouthpiece which you could talk into. And that mouthpiece, he would shout at you. He did the shouting, you didn't do any talking at all. And so the only communication was this mouthpiece. And except it was dual control, therefore if he pulled the stick, or you pulled the stick, he knew what you were doing, or you knew what he was doing. I mean, it was total dual control. Very basic instruments, no radio, no communication with the ground. And the only communication you had was with him.
Now, what was it like the first time when you took off? That was your first flight, up
yeah.
I mean, was it good?
Oh, beautiful. Oh, yes, first flight was great. And it was October, and it was lovely weather. And it was good. Oh, I mean, it was just, this was the first step for being a pilot. And that was great news. And you're a bit confident and cheeky by this stage, because you're... The next step was the solo, to get solo.
Well, tell me about the dual control. What did he have to teach you? What was he
straight and level, and climbing and gliding, then coming back to the airfield and showing a landing pattern, taking off. They never used to actually land. They used to fly near the ground and then take off and round again. And he'd gradually make you work you into it, guide you and teach you until...
And this is very much the simple flying, just going straight, simple circles.
Absolutely.
Nothing fancy.
Nothing at that stage. No, that's coming later.
And how...
Basically...
And you could feel the control stick moving as he moved it.
Yes.
And then you'd take over gradually?
No, he would say, you've got control. Or if he wanted control, he'd say, I have got control. Those are the words of command. You've got control, or I have control. I have control as an instructor, saying, right, I've got the aeroplane.
Do you think the instructor knew what he was doing? I mean, was he sympathetic to you and to the sort of problems you
Well, he hadn't been in the Air Force more than 6 weeks longer than I had. And his only asset was he had been a glider pilot. And a lot of people got creamed off if they showed above average tendencies, got creamed off as instructors. My instructor had been only 6 weeks early in the Air Force, and I was his first student.
But he seemed to be all right.
Yes, he was good. He was good. We had a great sort of relationship, really. He was good.
How many hours about before your solo?
Well, I should have the logbook here. It was 8 hours, 8.5 hours, I think.
That's quite quick. Well, it sounds quick.
Well, yes.
Did you have problems? What problems did you have? I mean, some pilots have problems taking off, some problems on landing, some problems with flying straight, not tilting the wing down. Did you have any particular problems?
I never had any particular problems, no. I mean, I'd probably be a bit slow at learning, but once I grasped it and got the confidence, I was way above most people, I think.
And what about your first solo? That also in a Tiger Moth, I presume.
Yes, oh yes, absolutely.
Tell me about the first
at this
solo.
Airfield, we're trying to think of.
What do you remember?
It was October, and it was even the evening, and they used to have the habit of getting people solo. At the end of the day, when the circuit wasn't very busy. Anyhow, the instructor said, right, he said, we're going to check you out today, and the flight commander will take you up for a check flight. So the flight commander took me up for a check flight. After one landing, we taxed in, and he said, right, you're going off by yourself. He jumps out, takes his parachute, ties his belt up, and off you go. There, taxiing out. It was a lovely evening. I remember a minute of it. And opening up, and phew, off you go, and airborne. You only do a circuit and came in and landed. But it was lovely. And this was the biggest step in your life, because I think when under training, the great fear was that you weren't going to get your wings, or you weren't going to get solo. Not the wings, you weren't going to get solo. And therefore, you were above everybody else now. You know, there were members, I think about four or five people on the course didn't make it of that 12. And that therefore, you were up with the boys, so to speak. And then coming into land, it was great landing.
Was it an exhilarating feeling, being in the air in an old machine? It wasn't old then, particularly the Tiger Moth.
It was a great exhilarating experience, and more exhilarating because you were by yourself. But your voice, you could still hear the instructor say, a bit more this, a bit more that, as you were coming in. You were talking to yourself. I think I talked to myself quite a bit. But it was great. And then
were you nervous before landing? I mean, landings...
No, you weren't. Because you were concentrating. You were up there. There was no time to be nervous. You were concentrating. So we're solo. Great. Because that was the next stage, and now we're getting your wings. And any pilot's training is to get to that, going solo.
So what next?
Aerobatics.
Now, can you run through some of the aerobatics and how you did it? So a lot of people don't know. I mean, we're even just banking, they don't actually know what it means. Could you explain how you did it?
Well, the basic was the slow roll and the loop. The loop was gathering up enough speed. I think it was 140, where the airplane really began to rattle. Then easing the stick back in a very gentle movement right up until you could see the horizon come above you. And then over you'd go and come down. Now, it sounds great. And he taught me how to do this. But then the first time, I think I was nervous, and I sort of fell out on top, and I didn't know where the hell I was going. But then I realised I hadn't got my speed enough. I remember saying, catch your speed up, boy. So I got my speed up, and next time I got around. But the funniest part...
When you were doing it, you'd be in with the instructor, this was
no,
dual
after,
control.
No, after dual control. Sorry, I'm talking...
What I mean is, when you learned acrobatics, you wouldn't have someone in with you. You'd be on your own.
You'd learn, your instructor goes through so many times that he thought you were proficient at doing the loop, and then you were sent solo to go up and practice. But the funniest part was the slow roll, because the slow roll, they put the aeroplane on its back and cut the engine, because otherwise the petrol will flood, and close the throttle and push the stick forward and fly inverted until you're ready then to roll out. And he told me that we were going to go through the slow roll process. So he said, now, button yourself in. I thought it was buttoned in. So I think I put one more button in. And then he said, right, here we go. And he went down and rolled it on his back. And I was petrified. I had my hand up on the front here, and I had my hand into left hand into the throttle. It was on the left hand side. It was a bracket, and when he started, the throttle was open, so there was room for my hand. But when we turned it on his back, he pulled it back, the throttle back, because it hit my hand, and he was shouting and screaming, which time I'd far more dangerous for me. I'd fallen. I thought I was going to fall out of the aeroplane because I hadn't really tightened my straps. And this is a pretty normal sort of initial excitement. But slow roll in the Tiger Moth was difficult because it was a difficult aeroplane to manoeuvre in aerobatics.
Did they teach you how to get out of a spin? I mean, you know, when you stall.
Oh, yeah, spinning all the time.
Tell me about spinning, because, I mean, it was a great killer in the First World War.
It was a great killer,
for young pilots, new pilots, rather. I mean, had they mastered exactly how to get out of it, how to get into
absolutely.
It?
Oh, absolutely.
How did you get into it and out of it?
Well, to get into it, you used to have to close the throttle, pull up the stick up until it stalled, because a spin is in a stalled spate. And then you, which rudder you've got on, left or right, you've got a left rudder on, it rolls to the left and then starts to gyrate. And there's nothing wrong with it, except in Tiger Moth it was quite easy to get out. You put the power on, put the stick forward, and it rolled out of the spin. You had to recover from being in a stall state.
A stall being where you haven't got enough power.
Yes. And this is, I think, why so many of them went down in the First World War. The aircraft weren't quite so stable as something like a Tiger Moth. So, very easy to get near the stall state, especially if we're looking at guns and looking at the enemy. I think that's why so many of them got stalled in.
Any other particular aerobatics you remember? I mean,
rolling off the top.
What's that mean?
You're going down to, up into a loop, and when you get to the top of the loop, you roll it into the level plane and don't go down on the other side. Very neat bit of aerobatics for when you're demonstrating an aeroplane. The spin, slow roll, loop, and rolling off the top. And then the next stage is forced landings.
I mean, forced landing means when you have no power.
Yeah, he'd pick a field and suddenly say, right, well, put that aeroplane down. And he would glide down and put it into a field.
And what was there to remember about a forced landing as opposed to a powered landing, you know, a normal landing?
You had no power. It was simulated. So they wouldn't let you, didn't actually cut the engine off. But, I mean, they throttled it right back and he'd keep his hand on the throttle. So all you had was the ability to manoeuvre it through its airflow, gliding and turning and making sure you got to the spot. Which was difficult to begin with, but soon you mastered the technique.
And you'd land into the wind? Or
just land into the wind. Yeah, that was most important. That's one thing they used to judge you on, quick enough to judge the... Therefore, that they used to train you to... My instructor trained me to have a sense of all the time knowing where I was and where the wind was.
Could you tell in the cockpit? I mean, was
No. I'm talking about drift now. So if anything did happen, you knew approximately the direction of the wind, so you were trying to land into the wind and not across it, so you didn't float. Because nothing worse than trying to land across the wind on a Tiger Moth.
Did you practice low flying at all?
Yes, low flying very much so. That was the other one. Lovely. And all the instructors loved it.
How low? And
well, that, I think it was something like 100 feet, but, I mean, the good instructors are right down on the deck. And they used to get bored, and they used to chase each other with their students in them. And I remember the one going right towards a haystack, and the idea was to pull it up at the last second, hopefully, because the other guy wouldn't see the haystack and go into it. It was that sort of attitude towards flying. And that was fun. And the other funniest thing was, on forced landings, was my instructor had a gun. And I didn't know, he put it in the cockpit, and when we'd landed on a forced landing, he did the landing on a forced field, and we taxed around this field. He said, you hold this aeroplane steady, so I'm getting out for a while. And he got out and went rabbit shooting. But these guys were frustrated with not being in the war, and
any other aerobatics you remember? That's quite a few. I can't think of any. I mean, fancy things like the so-called Immelmann Turner.
Oh no, not on Tiger Moth. No, sir. No, I didn't. There was anything fancy stuff on a Tiger Moth. She was a difficult aeroplane to fly, really. You had to fly her. She's not like later things like the Chipmunk, which you could fool around in. But no, the Tiger Moth was not an aeroplane to be fooled with.
So what else would you do when you fly? I mean, were they practicing any beginnings of fighter tactics or anything like that?
No, absolutely none.
No tactics at all? No gunnery?
That was the next stage.
No gunnery?
Nope.
So it's just this...
Just pilot training... to make sure that you were capable of getting your wings and going on to the stage you just mentioned, like, you know, fighting the war.
Now, when would you take your wings or your flying qualifications? When was that done? Was that done when you were at Luton?
Or no, in Canada.
Oh, so still training at this time?
That's still at Luton and out of the course of 24, I think there were about 18 of us left. Three pilots, including Ware, were posted to a school at Hillavington, advanced flying school at Hillavington. Not Hillavington, outside Kidbrook, outside Oxford. The rest were posted to Canada. We were pleased as punch because this was night fighter and fighter pilot training. So I was told to go on leave, and I went on leave and to report at Kiddington at a certain date. And then when I was on leave, I got a telegram saying postponed report in such and date. It was about 2 weeks later. And then during the next 2 weeks, there another letter came saying, please report to Manchester, where I immediately knew I was going to go overseas. And funny enough, just for your joke information, the time I finished my training, the time we got to the school in Canada to do our next training, it was our course who'd started with us, and they were just getting their wings. So we our idea of being a fighter pilot didn't work out very well.
You hadn't been, this was just the way it was. It wasn't,
yeah.
You hadn't been assessed.
Oh, no. No, I think they assessed us that we were likely boys to be good at being fighter pilots. They only had three appointments in the country, and I was lucky enough to get one of them. As I say, in fact, I was unlucky to get it. It never worked out. At this stage, the whole of training command in Britain was being closed down and moved to Canada, South Africa, Rhodesia, and also America by now. And the school I was going was closed down and moved to Canada.
And you were no longer posted to that, were posted to something else. Now, what about the voyage? Well, what happened when you went to Manchester? Was that
Heaton Park? Heaton Park is still very much part of Manchester. They built huts. And we were billeted in private houses. And
now, when would this be? That would be
December.
Right, about December,
yeah.
41.
Because most of November was hanging around on leave. And then we got told to go on Christmas leave. And as soon as we came back, we were told to report one evening in Heaton Park with our kit bag. Oh, ghastly. And then we got on the train and went to Gourock. And then we were on one of these lighters. We put in lighters and taken out in the water in the middle of the river. And to the Mount Calm.
The Mount Calm?
Yeah.
M-O-U-N-T and then C-A, Alan.
Yeah. And we were then taken on board and appointed to a deck. I think there were 30 to a deck. And theoretically, and all the bunk beds were there. And this is where you slept and lived for the next, turned out, 2 weeks.
So this was in January 42?
Yeah. No.
Late December.
Yeah, January 42, yeah. That was January 42.
And what were conditions like aboard the Mount Calm?
Well, they were basic but good. I mean, there were 20, 30 people, students. There were only 26 bunk beds. And you weren't allowed to hang your bunk bed to the horn went at 8 o'clock. And so it took 5 to 8, everybody was gathering like a race to get to their bunk beds. But some of us learned later that it was better not to have a bunk bed. It was quite nice sleeping on the table. But and we had to go and collect our food. We had to eat. We had to clear the decks. Every day we used to go out, polish everything and keep it for a captain's inspection. And off we went outside. We had to stay outside most of the morning, freezing to death. But it was pretty horrific, really, because you had duties, and one of your duties was either collecting the food, one duty was on deck, on the bridge, submarine spotting.
Did you do that?
Yes.
Tell me about
that. Right in the middle of the bloody night, and it was a raving storm. They roped the whole ship. They roped the ship so you were, could move from A to B on using ropes. And then we went out, two of us, we went out, and we had to move along a deck, only about that much, with the bloody sea roaring its head off, and then up onto the bridge, where we relieved two other cadet pilots. And we got a bamboozling from the bloody instructor, by the captain. He said, I want you to get out there and look for submarines. Well, when you looked ahead, there was the bloody sea, sort of right up there, and the thing was crashing down, and it was quite horrific. I can remember it now for a minute. And we went out there and looked for submarines. Looking for what we were looking for, I can't imagine, because it was so rough and so windy.
Were you seasick?
No. A lot of people were. Really badly seasick. One guy nearly climbed into a lifeboat and he was so ill and nearly died of exposure. And the other interesting thing was that on board were the wives and children of men already serving in Canada. And of course, there was a lot of canoodling going on, a lot of problems. But that didn't really involve too many of us. But one thing that I remember quite clearly, the instructions were air crew first, women and children second, if we were sunk. And that night after I was came back and I got into the bunk, and when we woke up in the morning, it was fairly calm, and only us, the Mount Calm, was the only boat. We couldn't see the other boat, which is escorting us, nor can we see the six destroyers. We were escorted by the American destroyers. Americans' first aid to Britain was First World War destroyers. And they were accompanying us. And there was a lot of flashing going on. And about 2 hours later, everybody was together again.
So the whole convoy had been...
Yeah, and we went, because we were going through a very heavy storm.
What do you remember of the convoy? What could you see of it normally?
No, just the other troop ship and six little destroyers were tossing and turning like mad. And also, we went so far south in January, we had our coats off. So we must have gone miles south, and then we crept up the coast, because we were on board for 2 weeks and didn't take our clothes off. You weren't allowed to take your clothes off. And if you went for the loo, you had to go with someone else, and there had to be somewhere in attendance, and you're only allowed to take half your trousers off. And this is all in case you got torpedoed. So it was quite an exciting journey.
Were you given your boat stations, and did you practice boat drill?
Yes, we practiced boat drill, and we practiced everything. I'm not sure we've done us any bloody good or not. I don't know. It was an extraordinary 2 weeks. A, that we never really took our clothes off, and B, that it was... We went through all sorts of... The night of the storm... The guys who went and picked up dinner, they picked up tripe. It came in big pans of floating in grease. Not many people ate that night. It was pretty rough. But arriving in... We went to Halifax. Curragh to Halifax. It took 2 weeks.
And what happened when you got to Halifax?
Well, Halifax was absolute heaven because there were lights and girls waving and big dockland, and anyhow, there was a big train there and we could see the train, and then we all, and you could walk down onto the deck. There was no light as you walk onto the ground, onto the land. And we were all shipped into trains and took off in this train to Moncton in Nova Scotia.
Now, that was where? Moncton.
Moncton.
Was that... what happened at Moncton?
Moncton was just a staging post. Staging post. Is where they put you into batches to be dispatched to America and Canadian schools. And...
where were you sent to?
Well, we were sent... The three of us who had been posted originally to the fighter school, we suddenly discovered we were going to America and starting the whole training again. So we had our logbooks and went flying to the office. Anyhow, we managed to persuade them all that we were half-trained pilots, we're going to start our training again. They agreed, and they sent us then to Carberry in Canada.
Carberry?
Near Winnipeg, Manitoba.
And that was to number 33. Now, I can't quite read. Is that SF?
Yes. Is it?
Or is it EF tiers again?
No, not EF tiers, no.
Well, just look, though, it's number 33, Advanced Flying Training School. That
correct.
Makes more sense.
Correct.
And you got there in round about March, right at the start of March,
yep.
Or end of February,
yep.
1942.
Yep. We hung around Moncton for quite a time.
How did they start you off there? What aircraft were they going to train you on there? And how did they start you off on it?
We're not going through Moncton anymore. Moncton was delicious because Moncton was the first time when we arrived in Moncton, we had to walk about a couple of miles in the middle of the night in the snow. We had our hats down over our heads and it was very, very cold but very beautiful. And we arrived in very well organised. We arrived into billets, and there was these lovely billets with the beds made up, and it was hot, and it was
this is at Moncton.
Yeah.
Sorry,
and there
on.
We, I remember so well this because we took our clothes off and threw our clothes off, and this was the first time we had a good change and put another uniform on, and then we went to breakfast, and there was sugar and bread and butter lying all over the place, and there. The first night that we went down to Moncton, we were ordering steaks and ice cream, banana splits, and generally having a ball. No drinking, because it was a what you call it state, a dry state. But lots of ice skating, and lots of boredom, because...
And no duties?
No duties, no. There was hundreds of air crew coming in or going out, coming in... like we were then, or going back to the UK.
So you were there about a month then?
Yep. That's
February 42.
We arrived in... Yes, we arrived in February 42.
Anything happened while you were there?
At Larson.
At Moncton?
On Moncton. No. Not really. I mean, it was just... fun. I mean, it was. I remember the most popular record was "I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas" by Bing Crosby. I mean, it was rat. And they had these skating rinks, and we met lots of girls, and it was enormous fun. Oh yes, I mean, it was paradise. Here we'd come, you eat like kings. It was wonderful.